A copy of the Siemens radar installation report was in her father's strongroom in Santarn House at this moment. On Monday, the file would be returned by special courier to naval headquarters in the nuclear-proof bunker complex built into Silvermine Mountain. However, her father was flying up to the sheep ranch at Camdebu over the weekend. She had already refused the invitation to accompany him on the excuse that she had so much work to catch up on. On Saturday and Sunday, Nana was judging the Cape Gundog trials. Gary was in Europe with Holly and the children. Isabella would have the top floor of Santarn House to herself for the entire weekend. She had full security clearance, and the guards at the front door knew her well. The wind was out of the north. The first snowflakes eddied down, silver bright against the grey sow's belly of the sky. There were a dozen men at the graveside. No women. There had been no women in Joe Cicero's life. Just as now there was none at his death. All the mourners were officers from the department. They had been delegated to this duty. They stood stolidly to attention in a single rank. All of them wore uniform greatcoats and scarlet pipe dress caps. All their noses were red. Red with cold rather than with grief. Joe Cicero had no friends. He had seldom evoked any emotion in his peers other than envious admiration or fear. The honour guard stepped smartly forward, and at the order raised their rifles and pointed them to the sky. The volleys rang out, punctuated by the rattle of the bolts. At the next order they shouldered their weapons and marched away, boots slamming into the gravel path and clenched fists swinging high across their chests. The official mourners broke their ranks, shook hands briefly and expressionlessly, and then hurried to the waiting vehicles. Ramon Machado was the only one left at the graveside. He also wore the full-dress uniform of a KGB colonel, and beneath his greatcoat the gaudy lines of his decorations reached below his ribcage. "And so, you old bastard, for you the game is over at last. But you took long enough to clear the stage." Although Ramon had been head of section for 2 years now, he had never truly felt that he had succeeded to the title while Joe Cicero was still alive. The old man had died grudgingly. He had held the cancer in remission for long, agonizing months. He had even kept his office in the Lubyanka right up to the last day. His gaunt, spectral presence had presided at every meeting of section heads. His will and his enmity had inhibited Ramon at every turn, right to the last. "Goodbye, Joe Cicero, the devil can have you now," Ramon smiled, and his lips felt as though they might tear in the cold. He turned away from the grave. His car was the last one remaining under the row of tall, dark yews. With his rank, Ramon now rated a black chaika and a corporal driver. The driver opened the door for him. As Ramon settled into the back seat, he brushed the snowflakes from his shoulders with his gloves. "Back to the office," he said. The corporal drove fast but skillfully, and Ramon relaxed and watched the streets of Moscow unfold ahead of the departmental pennant on the shining black bonnet of the chaika. Ramon loved Moscow. He loved the broad boulevards that Joseph Stalin had built after the Great Patriotic War. He loved the pure classical lines of some of the buildings and the brilliant contrast that they struck with those in the Rococo style, alongside the skyscrapers that Stalin had built and topped with their red stars. The concept of Soviet giantism excited him. They drove past the massive bronze statues of the heroes of the people, the monstrous figures of men and women marching forward together, brandishing submachine guns and sickles and hammers, raising high the socialist banner and the red star. There were no commercial advertisements, no exhortations to drink Coca-Cola or to smoke Marlboros or invest with Prudential Insurance and read the Sun. That was the most striking difference between the cities of Mother Russia and those of the crass and avaricious capitalistic West. It offended Ramon's instinct that the appetites of the people should be stimulated for such shoddy and indulgent goods, that a nation's productive capacity should be diverted from the essential to the trivial. From the back seat of the chaika, he looked upon the Russian people, and he felt a glow of righteous approval. Here was a people organized and committed to the good of the state, to the betterment of the whole, not the individual parts. He observed them, patient and obedient, standing at the bus stops, standing in the food queues, orderly and regimented. In his mind, he compared them to the American people. America. That fractious, childlike nation, where each man pulled against the other, where avarice was considered the greatest virtue, where patience and subtlety were considered the greatest vice. Was there any other nation in history which had perverted the ideal of democracy to the point where the freedom and the rights of the individual had become a tyranny on the rest of society? Was there any other nation which so glorified its criminals? Bonnie and Clyde, Al Capone, Billy the Kid, the Mafia, the black drug lords? Would Russia or any other sensate government emasculate and shackle its armed forces with such rules of disclosure and publicly debated budget allocations? The Chaika stopped at a set of traffic lights. It was the only vehicle on the broad thoroughfare apart from two public buses. Where every American had his own automobile, there was no such wasteful ownership in Russian society. Ramon watched the pedestrians cross the street in an orderly stream in front of his vehicle. The faces were handsome and intelligent, the expressions patient and reserved. Their dress had none of the wild eccentricity that would be evident in any American street. Apart from the predominance of military uniforms, the clothing of both men and women was sober and conservative. Compared to this educated and scholarly people, the Americans were illiterate oafs. Even the workers in the Russian fields could quote Pushkin. The classic books were amongst the most sought-after items on the black market. Any day that one visited the cemetery at the monastery of Alexander Nevsky in Leningrad, you would find the graves of Dostoevsky and Tchaikovsky piled with fresh flowers, daily tributes from ordinary people. By contrast, half the American high school graduates, especially the blacks, had reading skills barely adequate to follow the captions in a Batman comic book. Here, then, was the reward for almost 60 years of the socialist revolution. A structured and delicately layered society, secretive and protected in depth. Ramon often compared it to the Matryoshka dolls in the Beryozka tourist stores, those cunningly carved nests of human figures which fitted one within the other, the outer layers protecting and hiding the precious center. Even the Russian economy was deceptive to the Western eye. The Americans looked at the food queues and the lack of consumer goods in the gigantic gun departmental stores, and in their naive and simple-minded way, they saw this as the sign of a failed, or at least an ailing, system. Hidden from them was the internal economy of the military productive machine, a vast, highly efficient and powerful structure which not only matched but far outstripped its American capitalist counterpart. Ramon smiled at the story of the American astronaut perched in the nose capsule of his rocket, waiting for the blast-off, who, when asked by ground control if he was nervous, answered, "How would you like to be sitting on top of the efforts of 1,000 low bidders?" There were no low bidders in the Russian armaments industry. There was only the best. In much the same way, there were no siftings from the Equal Opportunity School of Employment, or rejects from IMB and GM in the upper echelons of the Russian military. There were only the best. Ramon was aware that he was one of them, one of the very best. He straightened up in his seat as the Chaika entered Dzerzhinsky Square and passed the heroic statue of the founder of the Organization of State Security on its raised plinth, and moved up the hill towards the elegant but substantial edifice of the Lubyanka. The driver pulled into the narrower street, which ran behind the headquarters, and parked with the rows of other official KGB vehicles in the rank reserved for them. Ramon waited for him to open the door, and then he crossed the road to the rear entrance and entered the building through the massive cast-iron grille doors. There were two other KGB officers ahead of him at the security desk. He waited his turn for clearance. The captain of the security guard was thorough and painstaking. He compared Ramon's features to those of the photograph on his identity document, the regulation three times before allowing him to sign the register. Ramon mounted to the second floor in the antique lift of etched glass and polished bronze. The lift and the chandeliers were relics from pre-revolutionary times when the building had been a foreign embassy. His secretary stood to attention beside her desk when he entered his office and greeted him as he hung his greatcoat at the door.
"Good morning, Comrade Colonel."
He saw that overnight she had set her hair with hot curling tongs into crisp, tight curls. He preferred it loose and soft. Katrina's eyes were almond-shaped and hooded, a legacy from some distant Tatar ancestor. She was 24 years old, the widow of an Air Force test pilot who had died flying a prototype of the new MiG-27 series. Katrina indicated the cardboard box on the corner of her desk. "What should I do with these, Comrade Colonel?" She opened the lid, and Ramon glanced at the contents. They were all that remained of General Cicero's presence. She had cleared the drawers of the desk that now at last belonged to Ramon alone. Apart from the gold-plated Parker ballpoint pen and a leather wallet, there were no personal items in the box. Ramon picked out the wallet and opened it. There were half a dozen photographs in the compartments. In each of them, Joe Cicero posed with a prominent African leader, Nyerere, Kaunda, Nkrumah. He dropped the wallet back into the box, and his hand brushed against Katrina's soft, pale fingers. She trembled slightly, and he heard her catch her breath. "Take it all down to archives. Get a receipt from them," he ordered. "Immediately, Comrade Colonel." She was an attractive, placid woman with a narrow waist and wide, comfortable hips. Of course, she had the highest security clearance, and Ramon had meticulously recorded their relationship in his day book. Their relationship had the tacit sanction of the head of department. Her flat was a convenient base for him while he was in Moscow, even though she shared the two rooms with her elderly parents and her three-year-old son. "There is a green flash dispatch on your desk, Comrade Colonel," Katrina said huskily, as she picked up the cardboard box. Her cheeks were still lightly flushed from the brief physical contact. Ramon felt a shaded regret that he would be leaving Moscow at midnight. On the average, he spent only a few days in the mother city in any one month. He saw so little of Katrina that her appeal was still fresh, even after 2 years.